Coming up on Boston Public Radio, we start with CNN's chief national security correspondent, Jim Sciutto, on the latest in Ukraine, what the U.S. can do about it, and why Americans should care. Then the Globe's Neil Swidey has a new book, Trapped Under the Sea, a nonfiction thriller about two deaths under Boston Harbor that very few of us even knew about. Then, can you imagine a film about A-Rod almost coming to the Red Sox, which is both drug-free and in which Theo Epstein actually smiles? Neither could we, but the Barnacle Brothers pulled it off. They join us.
Ever think about rewarding the random acts of kindness you see every day, even on the tee? We'll tell you about a Somerville lawyer who's doing just that. Then Harvard Business School historian Nancy Kane on the impact of Amazon.com. We know it's good for customers, but is it good for books? All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey, Marjorie, I want you to know, based upon the email, I didn't call you Marguerite once yesterday.
Oh,
so
thank
we're
you.
Making progress.
I am not Marguerite. That is correct.
So today, Vladimir Putin said that Russia has no intention of taking over the Crimea. However, he has shown no signs of scaling back Russia's presence in the region, despite pressure from the West. Joining us to go over the geopolitical forces that could determine the fate of Ukraine is CNN's chief national security correspondent, Jim Sciutto. Jim, thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning, Jim and Marjorie. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you for being with us. So give us the update, Jim. Where do things stand this morning or this afternoon,
well,
I should say?
A few developments. One, Secretary of State John Kerry arrived on the ground in Kiev. He's meeting with officials from the Ukrainian government. He went immediately to the site of those demonstrations in the main square in Kiev, where at memorials for the many protesters who were killed. In the bad news category, Russia declined an invitation to talk with the U.S. and Ukrainian officials as well as British officials. And you mentioned President Putin today saying that his country has no intention of occupying Ukraine. And I think in listening to his press conference this morning, you can see where the White House gets this point that Russia is dealing with a different set of facts than the U.S. and the EU is. I mean, for instance, he denied that there were any Russian troops in Ukraine. And when he was asked about those troops there that appear to be wearing Russian uniforms and speaking Russian and so on, he said, well, you know, there are a lot of different countries that have similar uniforms.
What was he doing, a Baghdad Bob imitation, Jim? Is that what he thought he was doing?
Well, you know, good memory there. You know, he did actually bring up Iraq, though, and this is Putin the defiant, right? And he said that the U.S. has a double standard, in his words, because it invaded Iraq and Afghanistan, in his words, without a U.N. resolution authorizing that action, or by, again, in his words, twisting, he said, U.N. resolutions.
Huh. So you know, a lot of people in the United States, Jim and I were talking about this before the show, aren't really clear on why this is a big deal to us. You know, we know that there's been a lot of criticism of Obama. We obviously know that Putin is spinning things in a way that aren't always related to the facts on the ground. But why does this matter to the United States? Why is this a big deal?
Well, here's the thing. You know, one reminder, and I was doing this yesterday a lot on CNN with a map. Ukraine is not a distant land. It is in Europe, and it is surrounded by close allies of the U.S. who are members of NATO. If you look at the western border of Ukraine, you've got Poland, you've got Hungary, Romania. These are NATO allies, and by the NATO charter, the U.S. is obligated to defend them if they're under threat. Now, Ukraine is not part of NATO. There have been talks in recent years about growing ties between Ukraine and NATO. But, you know, if you have, imagine a civil war inside this country, which is inside Europe, which is neighboring U.S. allies, you know, that is a problem for the stability of Europe. It's an economic problem, right? You know, the EU economy is taken together, one of the largest in the world, you know, on par with the U.S. But it is also certainly a political problem for obvious reasons. And in addition to that, you know, it's about the U.S.-Russian relationship. I think what you're seeing here, you know, President Obama said he doesn't want to be playing a Cold War chess game with the Russians over Ukraine. But the fact is you do have a Cold War-like tension here. inside this country, half of it pulled towards Europe, the western part of the country, and half of it pulled towards Russia. And Russia wants to reestablish its Cold War sphere of influence over Ukraine and into Eastern Europe.
But I'm hoping that in the worst case scenario, whether it's the United States or allies, it's Cold War at worst. No one's talking hot war. I'm thinking, reading the Washington Post story this weekend, the interview with Hamid Karzai, excoriating the United States out of Afghanistan, saying it's your war, it isn't our war, you've caused devastation in our land. I'm thinking, I'm the parent of somebody who gave his or her life in Afghanistan. Listen to Karzai. No one's talking about military action here. Are they, or are they, Jim?
They are not. No, that the administration's been very clear that the military options are off the table here. So you're not talking about boots on the ground. You're not going to see shooting and so on. Now, there are options in the military category, though, in that, for instance, later this week, a U.S. warship on a routine visit to the Black Sea, the Pentagon let us know yesterday that they're going to continue that. That's a show of force. Now, the Black Sea is just to the south. And why does Russia care about Ukraine? Because they have this major port in Sevastopol, the base of their Black Sea fleet. It's their only warm water port. So you'll have U.S. warships and Russian warships in close proximity. It doesn't mean they're going to shoot each other. They certainly have no plans to. But, that's a tense situation. That's also a powerful way for the U.S. to send a message.
We had called you, Jim Sciutto, the day after the Sochi Olympics were over, the $50 billion effort by Putin to say to the world, we're back. We're one of the leaders in the world. We had this cooperative, collaborative international effort. And I had said, what are the odds in the next couple of weeks that Russia invades a neighboring country to aggregate virtually all of the civilized planet? What would your answer have been?
Well, listen, it's funny. In the lead up to the Olympics, what threat were we talking about? We were talking about the terror threat.
Right.
Right.
And now you have this black swan event, right, an invasion. Now, the trouble is, though, there's precedent, right? Because during the Beijing Olympics in 2008, that was when Putin and Russia invaded Georgia. Very similar
point.
Circumstances. A former Soviet republic, Russia claimed there, as it is claiming now in Ukraine, that the ethnic Russians in the country needed its protection and so on. And that was a much larger scale invasion. You saw tanks literally rolling across the border. So you might call this one in Ukraine now something of a stealth invasion, but I think, heading in the same direction.
So, Jim, you just mentioned John Kerry arriving in town. Apparently, he's got $1 billion in loan guarantees to offer to the Ukrainians. But it's not clear to me why Putin should really listen to anything the United States has to say. I mean, what can we use to persuade him to scale back?
Well, I think at this point, the greatest American leverage is economic. And this is the package of sanctions that the Obama administration is drawing up right now, where you target Russian individuals, government and military officials, freeze their assets, visa restrictions, etc. That's a start. And it sounds like a small step, but I'll tell you, there's a lot of money in Russia. A lot of these officials have a lot of money outside of Russia, and they travel to their ski resorts and their President Putin himself has a big house in Sardinia in Italy. So you see these things, if you're restricting travel, restricting assets, that hits them. Now there are next steps that can go even further, where you would start to target Russian entities, Russian banks. There's talk of possibly excluding them from the international financial system. I mean, they're not there yet, but that's a possibility down the line. And we saw how that kind of squeeze, that economic squeeze, worked with Iran. Those economic sanctions really bit when Iranian companies couldn't do business internationally. I think that's where the leverage is. Now, you need unity to apply those kinds of sanctions, and so far there doesn't appear to be that unity. Germany pushing back, even the UK pushing back on some of these, because remember, we don't have a lot of trade with Russia. The Europeans do, and they get their gas from Russia, their natural gas. And Russia has used their natural gas as a pressure tactic before. They turned it off. They turned the spigot off to Ukraine a few years ago in the midst of another political dispute. Imagine that in the middle of a cold European winter.
Hey, speaking of Germany, Jim Sciutto from CNN, Merkel, the leader of Germany, is reported, I think by some German newspapers, of having said to the president, as in our president, Barack Obama, that she fears that Putin is out of touch. And the way that's being portrayed is the guy has lost it. He's in a parallel universe. He's not someone you can reason with, not because he's tough, but because he's crazy. Does anybody lend any credence to that notion? Because if it's even close to true, it's scarier than the facts themselves are.
Well, I haven't heard crazy, but the White House does say that the Russians are dealing with a different set of facts. You heard Samantha Power, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. yesterday, saying Russia's attempting to call up, down, and black, white on issues. And you saw that again today with President Putin's press conference, denying that there are Russian troops on the ground, saying a lot of different armies have, you know, similar uniforms, when everybody knows these are Russian troops. That's a problem if you're speaking by each other on these issues.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. And, you know, the other thing, you know, the other claim, right, they are, you know, the Russians are claiming that its citizens are under threat in Ukraine and that they are calling for Russian protection. There's no evidence of that. We've got a lot of reporters on the ground there, CNN does, and you haven't seen Russian citizens, you know, being chased to the hills. So, you know, that's another issue, because that, of course, can be used as an excuse for military action.
What is one extreme solution, I would assume, is to, and I don't mean this as quite as literally as it sounds, is let Russia have Crimea, which is to a great degree a Russian part of Ukraine. Is some variation on that theme a possible compromise at the end of the day here, or no?
Well, you do hear officials saying, well, not officials, but you hear people who've been in government saying, you know, when you look at the situation, it's possible they can't envision how you get Russia particularly out of Crimea, which they view as a national security priority, the headquarters of the Black Sea Fleet, their only warm water port. And, you know, from a practical standpoint, you will hear people who know this area very well saying, you know what, we might have to live with that, with the Russians there. And then, you know, the containment strategy is to make sure that they don't occupy other parts of eastern Ukraine and attempt to split the country apart. But, you know, remember, they invaded Georgia in 2008. They didn't give those two provinces back that they invaded then, and that's 6 years later. So, you know, Russia's all about creating facts on the ground.
We're talking to CNN's Jim Sciutto about the situation over in the Ukraine. Jim, I know you're not a pundit, you're a news guy, but there has been a lot of criticism, a lot of it from the usual suspects, about how Barack Obama has been conducting this delicate matter over there. What are you hearing about the assessment of the politics of this?
Well, you hear very strong criticism from Republicans. John McCain, sort of the leading force on this, saying that Obama, the administration, were naive when it comes to Putin. They should have been stronger. And they will also make the charge that Russia and other countries have watched U.S. actions, for instance, in Syria, where it pulled back from military action, and that they're taking advantage of it, making an argument, in effect, that you know, the Obama policy has been to pull back from the use of force, Iraq, Afghanistan, and that has invited action like this. And the fact that it's happening as the Pentagon has submitted a budget which shrinks the U.S. military, not dramatically, but you know, shrinks the size of the army, for instance, back to pre-World War II levels, has opened up the administration further to that kind of criticism. But listen, remember, when George Bush was president, the same thing happened in Georgia, right? In fairness, 6 years ago, when the military was a lot bigger and you had two occupations underway in Iraq and Afghanistan. So, you know, I don't know that that you can say that that all these things would necessarily prevent the kind of behavior we're seeing from Putin.
Jim Sciutto, Chief National Security Correspondent for CNN. Just a couple of quick final things from me. Does any of this straining of relationships between the United States and Russia have any impact on what we're doing or not doing with Syria? And for those who don't remember, obviously we're on the brink vis-a-vis the chemical weapons situation until this Putin possibility arose. I don't even know where that is right now, but is there any danger that whatever's going on there gets worse or falls apart?
There's certainly the danger. You know, the State Department tells us that or had told us in recent days that Russia's good at compartmentalizing, right? You have the issue in Crimea, but Syria, Iran, for instance, and Iran, Russia very key to the Iran talks, that they could separate. But you know, this is a major breach of trust. You're talking about economic sanctions. The president's saying it wants to isolate Russia internationally on this. You know, it's hard to imagine how this cannot affect those other foreign policy initiatives.
And last thing from me, Jim, are we going to look back on this? And I know this is pure conjecture, but I'll ask anyway. Are we going to look back on this a couple of years and say it was this that restarted the Cold War?
Well, Cold War-like, maybe, but remember, you know, the Soviet Union, well, doesn't exist anymore. Russia is a lot smaller world power. You know, economically, it's not a world power, frankly, these days. And you know, what you're not going to see is the U.S. and Russia battling in Latin America, Africa, mm-hmm. Asia. You know, every country a front in the Cold War. What we do appear to be seeing, though, is Russia reclaiming its sphere of influence, at least on its near borders, right? Ukraine and elsewhere, Georgia. And that's, you know, that has real consequences.
One last question, Jim Sciutto. And Jim Sciutto, for people who don't know, is CNN's chief national security correspondent. So where do you see us being in a few days from now? If we talk to you a week from today, what do you think is going to be happening?
I think you'll still, and again, this is just me, you know, pure conjecture, but
it's okay.
It's unlikely that Russian troops will have left Crimea at that point. And I think without real mediation and real communication between the West and Russia, Ukraine and Russia, you have the ingredients for violence on the ground. And that's a problem. You got a lot of guys with guns, right? You got Russian troops surrounding Ukrainian bases. You have Russia stoking these sort of ethnic tensions in the country with a lot of propaganda and so on. And that's a dangerous combination. So, you know, the chance of violence is real.
Jim Sciutto, we really, really appreciate your time. Thanks so much for spending it with us.
Happy to do it. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you. Jim Sciutto is CNN's chief national security correspondent.
You know, we're talking about the biggest issue in the world right now. Can I be parochial for 30 seconds
before we move on?
Who are the two people we talked about? John Kerry, Boston. Samantha Power, obviously our ambassador to the U.N., Harvard. I mean, it really is amazing how this community plays. And Barack Obama lived in Somerville. I know that doesn't really count, but no, I'm serious.
No, they call that the news biz, Jim.
What's that?
The dreaded local angle. How you can find the local angle in anything. Okay, up next. While most of us think the cleanup of Boston Harbor is a resounding success, it came at a tragic price. The lives that were lost in our effort to rebound from environmental ruin is the subject of a new book, and its writer, Neil Swidey, joins us up next.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. 25 years ago, Boston had the dirtiest harbor in America. Today, we've practically moved from worst to first, but our clean harbor came at the expense of men's lives. As part of the harbor's cleanup engineering mission, five men went down a dark, deep, oxygen-starved tunnel. Not all of them came up alive. The story is the subject of a great new book. It's called Trapped Under the Sea by Neil Swidey. Neil is a staff writer for the Boston Globe magazine. Neil, congratulations. Great to see you.
Great to see you both. Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, congratulations. I mean, what an incredible story this is, Neil. And I'm embarrassed to say I didn't even realize that this had happened when it happened. So tell people who don't know the story, as I did not before your book.
And nor did I, by the way.
About these five divers that went down into this tunnel.
Well, I should first confess that I didn't know about it either, and that was part of the appeal for me. Here we are, all journalists, and this story happened right under our noses. Part of it was that it was so remote where these divers were sent that no one really knew except the survivors of really what they had encountered. And the other thing is it coincided with John F. Kennedy Jr.'s plane going down. So the media's attention and the focus was all on that. And here was this incredible story of these five workers who risked their lives to improve ours.
And commercial divers.
Commercial divers. And they were sent to – it's almost unimaginable to think – the environment they were sent in. They were essentially sent to the moon. It just so happens the lunar landscape they encountered was 10 miles into the Earth rather than orbiting around it. But it was an unventilated, oxygen-starved, pitch-black, 10-mile-long tunnel. And at the end of it, where they had to crawl, the size of the pipe was 30 inches wide, so just barely wider than your shoulders.
And why were they traveling through this, Neil Swide? What was the goal of these five commercial divers? What were they intending to do that went awry?
They were the rescue mission. The harbor cleanup, as you said, is an amazing success story. It's so amazing that we forget how bad the harbor was.
Oh, I remember going out there as a young reporter, and they take you on tours, and the water was literally bubbling up in Boston Harbor. It was, and it smelled, and it was just disgusting. It was all these weird colors.
Exactly. It was a cesspool,
yeah.
And it had been allowed to just happen that way, and now it is this showpiece, and the whole Seaport District, all the restaurants and all the condos that are going up there, that doesn't happen without the cleanup of the harbor. So, and it was an engineering marvel that cleaned up the harbor. It's a two-step process. The first part was building that massive sewage treatment plant on Deer Island. The egg thing when you fly in from Logan Airport. The second part nobody sees because it's hundreds of feet below the floor of the ocean, and it's this 10-mile tunnel. But it's an engineering marvel in that it moves up to 1 billion gallons of treated wastewater through it every day. And it's only gravity that powers it. There's no electricity. There's no pumps. There's nothing in there except gravity. So it has to be built perfectly. And it chokes down in size. It gets smaller and smaller to move the flow through.
Can I just say before you go ahead, when I heard about this book and I didn't really know what it was about, I thought this was going to be the biggest yawn of all time. With all due respect, boy, am I dying to hear about the cleanup of Boston Harbor. I've read every MWRA press release through the years. But not only is this thing thrilling, as I said in the hall, I've only gotten through 50 or 60 pages so far. This is the most claustrophobic, for those of us who are claustrophobic, and I am, and I think one of the divers was too,
This
is one of the scariest tales of all time. It is unbelievable. So they go through this is one of the final steps of the cleanup, right?
The final step.
Okay, so what did they have to, what was the goal that day? What did they have to do?
So there have been a series of plugs at the end of the tunnel that protected the tunnel workers for the decade that it took them to build this tunnel. It was supposed to take 5 years. It took closer to 10. They had these safety plugs in there, but nobody ever figured out how those plugs were going to get out. And the whole tunnel wouldn't work, and the whole harbor cleanup couldn't go forward until these tunnel plugs were removed.
How many were there?
55
How
plugs.
Big?
They were 65 pound each. Each of them was in one of those different 30-inch pipes that connected at the very end of the tunnel. But in order, and again, these were it's the world's longest tunnel of its kind. This was some of the top engineering and construction firms and minds in the world who built this project, and they couldn't get along at the end. And so it was a game of corporate chicken. And they ended up pulling out all the ventilation, all the lighting, all the transportation out of the tunnel, and they still had those plugs in there. So they said, who can we get to go in? And
before you get there, when you said they couldn't get along, there was this inter-corporate fighting. Between whom? What do you mean? Fill in the blanks there.
So it's amazing. When you have these massive projects, there are multinational corporations. There's designers, construction firms. The owner, in this case, was the MWRA. They had a construction manager. The various parties couldn't figure out when to remove those plugs. The contractor wanted to take them out before they removed all the safety utilities out of there. And the construction manager said, no, what if something happens? At the very end, after you remove those things out, then we own the risk. So a lot of this became legal concern. The contractor owned the risk. No one wanted to dislodge that risk from the contractor's plate. So that's how you got to this point where they said, just send in these divers. These guys can do anything.
Because it does seem just really asking for huge trouble to send five human beings into a 10-mile tunnel with no lighting and no air. And
exactly.
That's what they did.
Yes. So they basically, and part of the book is about how we calculate risk. They were saying there were about 100 of these sandhogs who built the tunnel for the 10 years they were there. Let's put an added safety lever in place, these plugs, which were an additional secondary safety measure in place, to protect them, because there's a lot of them. At the end, let's put a very small number of people, five divers, to an extraordinary risk as a result of that. So that's where this calculation went through. And this is one of the things that fascinated me about how, again, really smart people can make really bad decisions, and guys in hard hats are asked to bail them out.
Yeah, well, that was a great point. It was the blue collar guys going in to do the guys that went to Harvard and MIT's last bit of work. So okay, so they go down. They're in these Humvees. They go down inside the tunnel. What happens?
So they're given, because it's so far out, they're given an experimental breathing system. It's too far out to take traditional bottled air supplies, because you'd use it all up getting out there. It took hours just to get out. They could take these specialized Humvees to get a good distance into the tunnel, but then they'd have to walk on foot because the tunnel got so small in terms of its diameter. So they were given by this engineering whiz, this Canadian guy that came in, and he dazzled people with this idea of, let's mix the liquid oxygen and liquid nitrogen right there in the tunnel. Let's let the divers breathe the vapors of this mixture right there in the tunnel, and let's do this. And so it was this kind of jury-rigged system that these divers were given. And they trust – divers take on these enormous risks, but they have to be able to trust the people above them that have figured things out for them.
Let me ask you a stupid question. You could see the Humvees going down into the tunnel, so they opened up the tunnel for the Humvees to go down. Why didn't the air go down?
So the air at the base of the shaft starts at Deer Island, goes 420 feet down, so like a skyscraper down, and then the tunnel starts. And this tunnel moves hundreds of feet below the floor of the ocean in a horizontal direction. It gets smaller and smaller. So there's good air right at the base of the shaft, at the start of the tunnel.
Okay.
But by the end of that tunnel, there's one or two breaths will kill you of your just the regular tunnel air.
Okay,
so we're talking to Neil Swarty, a writer for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, his book Trapped Under the Sea. So what happened?
So when they get out into this system, five of the divers go into the Humvee. Two stay there in the Humvee to monitor the breathing system for all five of them, while three trudge on foot in the dark, dragging their equipment to the very end of the tunnel. And at that point, at one point at the very end, the foreman of the three-man crew looks up and sees one of the divers collapse in front of him. He yells, "Is everything okay?" And before he could answer, another one goes down. And then they yell back to the guys in the Humvee and say, "What's the breathing supply? What's the oxygen supply at? Anything below 19% meant trouble." And the guy goes and checks, and he calls back and says, "It's 8.9." And then the line goes dead. And so then these the diver and the foreman of that crew and has to figure out how to save himself and save his colleagues, and then figure out how to get out of there.
And you know, the amazing part of this is, as you tell the story, beyond the constant claustrophobic feelings that every time you say 30 inches, it just, it's like being in a tomb, essentially, is you've said the term, Neil Swarty, engineering marvel several times, and it is. So an engineering marvel, its last step is something that sounds like I could have designed. Basically, a jury-rigged, half-assed, if you'll excuse the expression, and I know there are alleged experts doing this thing, but did the guys know how risk-laden this final part of their journey was, the divers themselves?
They didn't, and that's one of the fascinating things to me, not only for the divers, the survivors who made it out, but also the people who signed off on this plan, because these were brilliant people who made a host of great decisions along the way on this project. And what I wanted to know from them is, how did this look good to you at the end? And that gets into the organizational behavior psychology issue of when a project is way over budget, when the contractor is being fined $30,000 for a day for every day it's late, when there's a federal court order breathing down your neck to get this thing done, and you have this impasse where smart people can't get along, they're more receptive to ideas that haven't been fully thought out. And, you know, as a former lawyer, you would know this. They're more concerned about not weighing in too much on these plans, because if you touch it, you own it, is the sort of thinking on this. So they think, well, this responsibility lies with the contractor. they've got to have it worked out. And everyone sort of figured the other party had it worked out and they didn't want to get too involved.
But did they know how I mean, the more you tell the story, the more it sounds like the memo that the New York Times published after the BP explosion in the Gulf, when they knew that they were engaging in a really risky proposition that ended up costing, I can't remember, a dozen people or whatever it was. Did the contractors, did they know, even though they wouldn't say it out loud, how risk-laden the effort was, or did they delude themselves into believing, no, as you say, someone else is taking care of it, it's going to be fine?
For a year, the contractor argued against this plan of sending divers in. In fact, I found a memo that said, in this prescient, eerily prescient way, saying, if we follow this sequence you're suggesting of pulling out all the ventilation and then sending the divers in, the risk of catastrophe will be exponentially higher. And yet, that same contractor went with this idea at the end because they were at wit's end, they were $100 million in debt, and they couldn't figure out a way out of this, so they just went along with it.
We're talking with Neil Swarty from the Boston Globe magazine, who's written this fascinating book, Trapped Under the Sea. So you left us at a very crucial point there. We don't want to give away your entire book, but when you left us, one guy with two other guys down had figured out that he had to figure out how to fix this oxygen problem so he could live. Can you tell us any more about how
sure.
he did
well,
it?
Sure. Well, I mean, then I hear from people who get upset because they're midway through the book and they don't want to figure out the but basically, that one diver, through incredible quick thinking on his part, because he lived and he told me later that it was, in retrospect, the worst moment of his life. And it felt like the best moment in his life. And this is another thing I had to understand with sort of oxygen deprivation and what it does to you. He said it felt like I just tossed back a few cocktails and I was going to this beautiful place. And some part of him realized tossing back a few cocktails is not how you want to feel when you're buried under the ocean. So he lunged for this backup supply that changed the supply that the three divers at the end were on to the one that was just that they carried with them, one bottle, and that saved his life.
Who are the villains in this story? I mean, who are the – we know the good guys. And by the way, one of the things you do beautifully is you go into great detail about all of the men and their families.
Families,
and their
yeah.
I mean, I love that. But who are the villains? I mean, who were the bad guys?
Well, the most obvious one is this Canadian engineer who came up with this plan. And he, again, dazzled people with this idea that he had figured it out. He had done some incredible work at other projects and was kind of known as the guy who could get big multinational corporations out of a jam. And I think part of that psychology, it was kind of carried into his identity, and he didn't want to admit he didn't have it figured out. So he's the clearest one, because at a certain point, this wasn't the first day that this happened. This was day three. And day one and day two, there were warning signs. And these divers who were in a different environment, who were drawn to this job because they were told they'd make history in their field, they were saying things aren't worked out here. But that information wasn't getting sort of escalated up to the right places. So that's another issue of how that happens here. But then beyond that is, who asked this guy to come in at the end and come put together this plan, and who closed their eyes essentially rather than look closely at what they were asking these men to do?
Who?
That is the combination of the contractor, the construction manager, the engineer, the owner, all good people, I think, who did incredible work. But at the end, because they were so frustrated and there was so much mistrust that it built up, couldn't figure things out. And that's one of the things. When you mention BP, you can read this book and it can explain what happened at BP. It can explain what happens even, I think, in non-disasters like the rollout of Obamacare.
I was just going to say, where no one's in charge.
No,
all these
exactly.
contractors.
Yeah. Yeah. So that is a great question. I mean, what is the takeaway? That we need to have one person? This is where the buck stops? Is that the takeaway, the moral of the story, as it were?
I think there's a couple of things. You know, there's this idea of the Swiss cheese model here, that it's not, you know, disasters don't happen when there's some big failure. It's usually when there's a bunch of little failures that line up in a particular, the holes in the Swiss cheese line up, and that's what happened here. So you have to be mindful of those holes, the smaller things. You also have to figure out that this idea of deadlines and pressures and late penalties and low bid construction, all the things that as taxpayers we like, sometimes have perverse incentives built into them here, because here was a thing where the final creative solution to solving this problem, which was made possible only because of the work of the divers, including those who didn't make it out, was because they had put money, taken money off the table and said, what do we need to do? Let's not worry about who's going to have to pay. It's too costly in human terms, in financial terms even, to let this thing go without figuring it out. And when they did that, you know, true creative, brilliant thinking can emerge.
Why'd you do this? We only have a minute or so left, but why, you mentioned at the top, which surprised me, that you didn't know about the story. We went back and read Globe stories by, I think, Joanna Weiss, who's now a columnist, and some other people this morning. Why'd you decide to spend a significant chunk of your life doing this?
It was one of those stories that I did a piece 5 years ago in the Globe magazine, and I spoke to the divers. And usually when I do in-depth magazine pieces, at the end, I'm ready to move on to something else. And this one I couldn't stop thinking about. I couldn't stop thinking about these workers that we asked to risk their lives so it'll make ours better, who they are. They're always anonymous. And then how smart people can make these bad decisions so that we can avoid them in the future. This became kind of a vehicle for exploring a lot of the things I wonder about in the world.
You explored it beautifully, Neil Swadda. You
congratulations
did.
Again.
Can't
You've done an
so
absolutely
much.
Wonderful job, and it's just a fascinating, if very upsetting, story. Neil Swadda is a staff writer for the Boston Globe magazine. The new book, the title again, is Trapped Under the Sea. Thank you so much for coming in, Neil.
Thank you.
I want to be
me.
In the movie, by the way, just as when you, okay?
I think they were all Navy SEAL types, Jim.
I don't want to be one of them.
Okay. Up next, we look at another part of Boston's history, how the Red Sox almost sealed a deal with Alex Rodriguez. It's the subject of a new documentary that's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. In baseball, it's always fun to ponder what-ifs. How would Red Sox history be different if the team had been able to bring Alex Rodriguez on board a decade ago? It's the subject of a new documentary. It's called The Deal. Here with us in Studio 3 are the brotherly duo behind this short, terrific documentary, Nick Barnicle and Colin Barnicle. Nick and Colin, great to see you both.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much for coming in. So I'm kind of an idiot when it comes to sports, I know about Alex Rodriguez. When I think of him, I think of all these women, the stories about the strippers, the stories about the drugs. I didn't know about this fascinating story about the Red Sox going after him in 2003, which I guess I should have known. But this is what you talk about. It's 10 years ago, though. Why'd you pick this story?
So it is 10 years ago. By the way, a tough act to follow, Trapped Under the Sea. I'm going to put that up tonight.
Isn't that great?
Amazing.
Oh, yeah.
Amazing. It's 10 years ago. So take everything you know about Alex Rodriguez, throw it out the window, and try to go back 10 years. Winter of 2003, he is arguably the most famous athlete, highest paid athlete, well-respected, well-liked. And the Red Sox want him, and he wants to leave Texas Rangers where he's at.
And there was no drug taint then, right? Nobody was talking about this guy being on PEDs or anything else. He was going to be surpassed. Bonds hadn't gotten there yet. All of the great home run hitters, he was going to set all the records and march into the Hall of Fame, right?
Yeah, he was the face of baseball, no doubt about that. He had like the most home runs he was very young. He was 27 years old at the time, 28 years old. And he was coming off this enormous contract that he had signed 3 years before. He was the youngest free agent in baseball history, and he signed a $250 million deal.
Say that again, please.
$250 million deal. And to put this into perspective, former President George H.W. Bush had sold the team, the Texas Rangers, for $200 million 2 years before they signed one player at $252 million.
And by the way, for those who don't remember that far back, in this great piece these brothers did, the great Gordon Eads describes the expectations surrounding A-Rod's possible arrival in Boston. Listen to what Gordon had to say.
He would come to Boston, rival Ted Williams in popularity, lead the team to two or three World Series, and wear a Red Sox cap into Cooperstown. And that probably was a vision shared by a lot of Red Sox fans.
Okay, it happened and then it didn't. Nick, do the lead up until it all fell apart, and then your brother can tell us how and why it fell apart. This was going spectacularly well, right?
It was going very well. So Alex Rodriguez is approached by his owner, Tom Hicks, who he's owned Liverpool as well, so a Boston connection. And he's approached, and proposed a trade. They say, look, you are owed so much money, we want to get rid of you pretty much. Where do you want to go? And he said, I either want to go to the Yankees or I want to go to the Boston Red Sox. The Red Sox get involved at that point. They have a deal done. Theo Epstein and Jed Hoyer, who are now in Chicago, fly to New York where Alex is with his then wife at the Four Seasons, I think. And they go up and
– in the middle of the night.
In the middle of the night.
They're hiding. So
all
no
29-year-old guys. Yeah. And they're talking about $250 million contract. And they get a deal done right there. None of them are lawyers, by the way. They get a deal done. Although I guess Theo has a law degree. So they all of them meet in the middle of the night at this gigantic suite. And they get a deal done. And Alex Rodriguez signs a deal with the Boston Red Sox that Jed Hoyer still says he has.
And so what happens, Colin? Why does this history-changing event, why does it fall apart?
It's kind of like what you guys were talking about in the last segment about risk aversion in terms of really smart people making decisions, because it really gets to a point where you really don't – you can't see, you know, the wood from the trees, the trees from the forest type of thing. And, you know, it came down to a fact where if you take a step back 10 years later, you're asking the best player in baseball to walk away from something about, you know, $23 million. And the Players Association,
the Red Sox, essentially said, "You got to give up some
salary. You
got to
give up. You got
to make
give
the deal." And Rodriguez, apparently in that 2 a.m. Yeah. meeting, said, "Yeah, I'm willing to do it. I want to come to the Red Sox. I want to get out of here."
Yeah, he said, "I need to do this. I want to get out of Texas. I want to be in the limelight." If there's anything we know about Alex now, is that he is addicted to being in the press. So he wanted to be in that Boston New York rivalry somehow. He wanted to be the savior of Boston. And basically what happened is he said, yes, you know, there's a couple things that I want instead of the millions. The rights to my likeness was one of them, which is weird. and he also wanted, you know, a couple other things like an opt-out clause so he could become a free agent after 2 years. But basically they bring this to the Players Association, which is the strongest union in the United States. MLB Players Association is incredibly strong. And basically the union said, there's no way we're doing this. This sets a terrible precedent. He's the face of baseball. We are not having it in the press that some guy, our main guy, took $23 million less than his contract says he would, because it would set a terrible precedence for every single other player under him.
So when it falls apart, Jen, we're talking to Nick and Colin Barnicle, who've done this wonderful piece called The Deal, this documentary, a short one. I love it. 22 minutes. I get the whole deal in here about how A-Rod almost became a Red Sox. And if that was the end of the story, I assume it would have been an 11-minute thing. But the issue was not that he not come to the Red Sox. The issue is what happened next, Nick, and what did happen next?
What ended up happening was he went back to Texas. They did a little veneer, PR veneer, and made him the captain there. And about 2 weeks after that, a weird press conference where he's sitting on the dais with a C on his chest in Texas, he's seated next to Brian Cashman in New York at an odd dinner. And Brian Cashman, the GM of the Yankees then and now, says to him, you know, what happened in Boston? Why did it not work out? And Alex walks him through why it didn't work out point for point, having known the deal. And Cashman, a light goes off his head and says, hmm. And then Aaron Boone, who was the third baseman, as we know, Aaron Bleepin' Boone from the fall before as he hit a home run versus the Red Sox.
It sent them into the World Series.
That's right. Aaron Boone was playing pickup basketball in California, trying to get some cardio in, blew out his knee. All of a sudden, there's an opening at third base. Brian knows how to get the deal done with Alex, and he says, do you want to move to third base? And Rodriguez is so desperate to leave Texas and go to New York, he says yes.
So here's what I didn't understand about this is the Red Sox could have paid him more and gotten him, correct?
It was a situation where a lot of the things that we didn't get put into it the Red Sox were going to trade Manny Ramirez yep. to the Rangers. And Manny's contract at the time was gargantuan itself. It was over $100 million. And Manny Ramirez is known kind of as a clown, you know, not the best left fielder in the game, but a very good hitter.
Yep.
But kind of their financial relief for the Red Sox, a large part of that would have been shipping that massive Manny Ramirez contract over to Texas. The good thing that the Yankees had was they didn't need to ship a huge contract out. It was all dollars okay. and cents to them. It was much cleaner and a simpler deal.
So it wasn't like it was the Red Sox' fault that this fell through.
No, it was just as, you know, Theo says in it, and Buster Olney, the great reporter, baseball reporter, says, you know, you can't have a team where a guy's taking up 25% of your payroll. You just can't win like that.
And I have a couple of non-baseball questions here. I'm watching this documentary, and it was fascinating to me. As I said, I'm not a big sports person, but it was fascinating. But I'm looking at Theo Epstein and the guy from and Larry Lucchino from the Red Sox, and then some guy from New York. Sitting when you're interviewing him at this table that looked like it belonged to the Queen Mother over there in Buckingham Palace.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable. Where were they?
Buckingham Palace.
No. I guess.
That's an interesting question. So I think we had 7 interviews. A bunch of them are in hotel suites.
Okay.
But the what you're referring to is some
long mahogany looking table.
That's
very shiny.
Larry Lucchino, and I think that fits his personality. That's what he deserves. So we went out. We were in Orlando. There's 2 winter meetings every year in baseball, and there's one in early November, and there's one in December. It all happened at these 2 meetings. And we ended up, I forgot how we get it, but it was at the hotel next door. There was a conference going on, and we somehow said that the conference room was ours.
Okay.
And we took it over, and we did the interview right there. And everyone in that film went out of their way to be in this thing and was so gracious to us. So big thanks to especially Mr. Lucchino, who was in the film.
Come on, wait a second. The losers became the winners, the Red Sox, and the winners, the Yankees, became the losers. It's like the Red Sox. They express in your film how horrible it was, how painful. This is the Red Sox leadership, how depressed they were when they lost them to the hated Yankees. It turned out to be the greatest boon probably in the history of Red Sox Nation, right?
Jim is just making excuses here because Jim has sort of a prickly past with Theo Epstein, who was very charming to you guys. In your documentary, less charming to you, Jim, when you have interviewed him in the past.
No, I don't want to say that. He's only the rudest person I've ever spoken to. Listen to Theo Epstein.
At this point, you might say, with the Barnacle gentleman here, you might say, is the problem Jim?
Exactly.
Or is the problem Theo?
Well,
I don't know.
Theo's, of course, a good friend.
Let's before you go ahead, here's Theo in this. Theo Epstein is now the president or whatever he is of the Chicago Cubs. He makes the case for getting A-Rod to, quote, reverse the curse after the Sox were obviously humiliated by the Yankees the year before they finally won it all. Here's Theo.
I was in Yankee Stadium in the scout section behind home plate. You know, it was the end of my first season as GM. You know, Boone comes up and hits that walk-off. It's just like a punch in the gut. You got, you know, Yankee Stadium fans going crazy, pouring beers on me. I'm trying to get out of there. It sucked the humanity right out of you, is the best way to put it. The closest thing to it is like Greek mythology. You know, I mean, it's the entire region is just waiting for us to finally get over this hump.
Okay, here's the question everybody wants to know, you two Barnacle brothers. How many hundreds of hours of film did you have to do to get Theo to smile for 3 seconds? He is the most unpleasant, rude, condescending
guy
I've ever met. Yeah. So what is that about?
I think I poised the question very well, Jim. It might not be Theo.
So it was a situation where I actually worked for the Boston Red Sox.
You did?
Yeah, for 3-4 years, something like that. So he saw me more as someone he had seen every day. So there was a conversational kind of tone we've had with him since I was, because I was 18 when I worked there. I was a mailboy and I was really, really bad at that. I'll go on record now as saying I'm pretty sure I lost the Boston Red Sox 3 games in the middle of August in 2005 when I forgot to ship the scouting reports down to Florida, and we missed the playoffs by a game and a half. So
God.
Theo's very forgiving. Don't worry about it. Colin. So wait a second. You two Barnacle brothers, Nick and Colin, the only thing more amazing than the fact that in 22 minutes you got Theo to smile more than once was the fact that you kept your father out of this thing. Before I started watching, I think we can all agree he is the biggest Red Sox fan on the planet.
Degenerate.
Degenerate. So how hard was it to keep Mike Barnacle out of the deal? He's not even listed in the thank yous, is he, at the end of the thing?
No, of course he's not thanked.
How did you pull that off? How hard was that?
Well, I mean, Mike B is one of the biggest, maybe the biggest, this isn't a contest, but he is a degenerate Red Sox fan and a degenerate baseball fan. And our biggest thing with him was, we just want to tell this thing straight. Because we happen to live in New York now, and although we don't like the Yankees, you know, you have certain, you know, integrities that you want to adhere to, and that's why we wanted the Yankees in it. He would have rather seen other stuff in there that was...
we wanted to make the piece ironic, and it just wasn't going to be ironic if you put our dad up on screen. In 2004, we won.
And then in 2007, we won. Yeah. In 2013, we won. So Keeping him out of it was actually pretty easy. He stays out of our work, and I don't know what he does now, but I stay out of his work.
Yeah, and the thing with Rodriguez, obviously, that was the game, and again, I think that was the game that the Red Sox won four in a row. Was that the year that they won four?
Yeah, the year after this thing, right?
So Alex Rodriguez looked a lot less appealing, I guess, in hindsight.
Yeah, I mean, Alex was, I mean, you know, at that time, right up until the point where he has that fight with Veritek, he was seen as just a golden child. And
yeah.
Then immediately after they walk down the first baseline and they get into that, and he gets into Jason Veritek's face, or catcher at the time, it was like something switched. And he just became like persona non grata.
Why don't you guys make this thing? I mean, this is 10 plus years after the fact. All everybody talks about is, speaking of degenerates, what a real degenerate Alex Rodriguez is. He's been, for those who don't know, banned from baseball. It was originally a season plus 50 games. Now it's down to a season. He's reviled. Well, he has to watch Derek Jeter on his retirement tour this season, which I'm sure is killing him. Why'd you decide a decade after the fact, Nick, to do this?
A really simple reason, to bring it back to our father. We were raised in the Church of Baseball, and it's an interesting story, and we're young guys who like baseball, which is a rare thing these days. And there was a certain element of risque not talking about what everyone talks about.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that we could get all these people to sit down with us and bring them right up to the moment where he may have become a huge degenerate, as Colin points out, was interesting.
So yeah.
Why did you say that young guys don't like baseball anymore?
It's the average
guy thing?
Yeah, it's the average viewership. Is like 57 years old, yeah, and so we wanted to make the piece upbeat and to appeal to maybe a younger crowd, and also, I mean, it's kind of funny. It's like an ironic piece. It's like you look over the last couple months with Alex Rodriguez, and every, you know, this is the end of baseball. He's a tyrant. He's terrible. When 10 years ago, you read any paper about the guy, and it's like, this guy is going to break every record, and we're going to have plaques. We're going to retire his number across baseball right next to Jackie Robinson. Like, it was that level of insanity with this guy.
I have two last things for you guys quickly, if I can. I understand why the Red Sox, Lucchino and Epstein and others, spoke to you, and the reporters made sense, even though some of them were great. Why did the general manager of the Yankees, when this turned out to be such a disaster, why was he willing to share with you his recollection of the deal, Colin?
We kidnapped him. held him for ransom for 3 days. What was it really?
Why did
I'll
he
give Brian,
this?
Brian Cashman, I'll give him the most credit of probably, I mean, he's probably the most to lose, honestly. At the time, it wasn't quite clear whether he was still being sued by Alex Rodriguez in a court of law. Why did he do it? He did it because he knew what we were going to tell. We were not going to ask him about steroid use, about, you know, why did you trade for this guy? And I think it was an interesting time and a look at something that we never asked him whether he regretted it or not. But maybe he feels like he regretted it. He did get a ring out of it. They did win a World Series, but it was just an interesting look back 10 years ago. I think it was so far removed that he was willing to talk about it.
Where do people see this thing?
Great question. Prospectproduction.com.
Prospectproduction.com.
Yeah.
Watch ESPN.
Watch ESPN. Google it. Barnacle Alex Rodriguez ESPN is probably the easiest way to find it.
It's terrific.
We'll link to it.
By Trapped Under the Sea by Neil.
And then
if you want a little lighthearted look, maybe Google our name and watch it.
We both loved it,
no,
I
you
have
did
to
a
say.
Great
big
job.
Baseball
you
fan
did a
here,
great
a
job.
Smaller one there. We both
it
loved it.
It was absolutely fantastic. I was very impressed. Anyway, we've been speaking with the filmmaking duo, Nick Barnacle and Colin Barnacle. Their new documentary is The Deal. You just heard how you can watch it. Don't miss it. Thanks, you guys, for coming in. Up next, we're going to ask you how far you can go out of your way to say thank you. An anonymous bearer of gratitude is making his thanks known on the MBTA. So what's stopping you? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie. And a regular MBTA commuter is handing out what he calls politeness points on the T. These are small pieces of paper with an encouraging message printed on them, like, thanks for being polite today. He's been handing these out to fellow T riders who perform good deeds on trains along the transit lines. Now, since it's pretty common for people on the T to keep to themselves, when someone does carry out a notable act of kindness, this guy, his name is Bill Durkin, by the way, thinks that he or she deserves some recognition. So we want to know what you think about this practice, and not just on the tee, by the way. Should we be rewarding people when they do something kind or empathetic with things like kindness points or something as simple as a thank you? Do you thank people when there are small acts on their part? Do people around you do it? And if everybody did it, wouldn't it create a better feeling in what is generally a pretty cold, pretty impersonal world that we hang out in? Our number is 877-301-8970. By the way, if you call, you'll be recipient of a politeness point because one of us will thank you for having made the call. I am one. You know, you criticize me from time to time on air for
I don't think I'm sort of in my own little world kind of thing.
One of the things I am good at, if I say so myself, I am a huge user of thank you. I think it really matters. It really connects you in a lot of ways. And if you do something nice, it's a really nice way to, you know, to connect to people. It's
a good thing.
That
thing about if, you know, the tree falls in the forest and no one's there to hear it.
I know it very well,
yes. Does it make any noise? Well, this is sort of like if you run around doing all these nice gestures, but no one knows about them because you're doing them anonymously. It's great you're doing them anonymously, but it's kind of like, nice to have someone recognize it. You know, imagine if you get up on the tee, Jim, and you gave your, not that you would ever ride the tee, but when you did ride the tee many eons ago.
Well, I can understand the concept.
Your seat to an elderly person or, you know, a pregnant woman, and somebody on the tee noticed that and came over and handed you a little.
I think it's great.
You feel like, wow, you know, I mean, I did it and it made me feel good, but it's also nice to get a little bit of recognition, you know. So it's kind of a, it's kind
and
of
somebody
a nice
noticed.
Thing. And also, I tend to be, you know, especially in sports, you know, a competitive person. And I mean, it's ridiculous to sound like you're competitive in yoga. That sounds ridiculous, but I am. And this
yoga?
Woman, yeah. Yeah,
okay, go ahead.
Because I go to the macho yoga where everybody does the hot room and all that kind of stuff. And you're, you know, can you do the more difficult stuff? Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, you're competitive with the person that's like 6 inches away
from
you.
Dying to hear where this is going.
Well, this woman just looked over me at the end of class and made some joke and laughed and said hello. And I felt totally, I know what it was. She thanked me for taking away her blocks. And my whole attitude about her totally changed. But before I'd been trying to, you know, beat her, and now I liked her. So, you know, those little thank yous. I mean,
by the way, that's a good story, actually. I think it really, you know, it is an incredibly small thing, but one, it does make a difference. And two, the absence of thank yous and acknowledgments of people's behaviors, particularly if it's not directed to you, by the way. There are two kinds of thank you. I mean, there's one where someone does something for you, which the hope is that most people listening will thank people for their generosity. But what this guy's talking about, this Durkin character who's handing out these politeness points on the tee, he's talking about thanking people for generous acts directed to other people.
I know. It's just really kind of great. And he's a lawyer. Did you say that already?
I didn't say that.
He's
no.
a lawyer.
Yeah.
Makes it even more interesting.
877-301-8970. So we're sort of on a thank you jag here, both during our pledge discussions and here. Do you do it? Would you do it? And by the way, you know what we're going to hear from people, I guarantee you, is I'm nervous to go up to somebody else whom I don't know, who I'm not having an interaction with, and even talk to them. That's part of the problem, too. People are worried about how someone's going to react to you invading their space. Because we really do have this wall thing between us and everybody else. 877-301-8970. So the guy's handing out politeness points, some of which say things like, thanks for being polite today. Thanks for doing a nice thing. Is it, I mean, what do you think about this? And is it too middle America for people in New England? I mean, there is an, it's not an urban kind of thing, but
it sounds a little hokey. I mean, it does sound.
You know what it's like,
hokey.
By the way? You know what we should talk about
what?
One day? I can't think of the guy's name. I feel horrible. He's a civilian employee in the police department. We've discussed this before. You ever heard of the Name Tag Project? It's a variation on a theme. This guy, I think he lives in JP. One weekend a year, I think in the summer. I'm quite sure in the summer. He does some sort of event where everybody in the community wears a name tag.
Okay.
Why is that? Because when you've seen your neighbor or your coworker 400 times and they've told you their name 398 times, you can't ask anymore.
Yeah.
When you address someone by name, just like saying thank you to them, it creates a connection. It creates a bond. Why are you looking at me like this? You don't think that's a great thing?
Well, because my neighbors invited me over for a brunch a couple of years ago.
Oh, this is a great story, guys.
There were only five of us.
This is great.
And we all wore name tags.
I'm not talking about that.
I didn't know what to make of that.
That's odd.
I hope they're not listening.
That is odd. Well, if they are, they won't be inviting you over yet again. 877-301-8970. So we're using as a jumping off point what this Bill Durkin guy is doing in the tea, these politeness points. Do you do this kind of thing, or do you find it too weird to even relate to? Emily, you're in Cambridge. You're first on Boston Public Radio. Hi there, Emily.
Oh, hi, guys. Thanks so much for taking my call. Love
well, thank
your show.
You. Well, thank you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. How important to do. No, I think this is really important. One of the things that I had taken a business etiquette dinner about 10 years ago, and one of the things that I took away most that was most important from it is the woman said, say thank you to everything. When you get in a cab, the first two words out of your mouth should be thank you. And when someone replies to your email, you say thank you. It's the greatest way. And Jim, you just made a great point about using someone's name. It's just a wonderful way to engage. Oh, it's huge. And I actually just wrote an article about how to get people to listen to you. And those were two of my points, saying thank you and using people's name. Because think about when you're driving and you let someone in, and they don't even acknowledge you and how angry you get.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, Emily, also the name thing. I don't know if you mentioned this in your piece, and we're done with you in a minute. Please hang on. I'd love to see your piece. Tell our producer where it is.
I want to know how you remember everybody's name, Emily.
But let me say one thing about name. When you work with someone, you live next door to someone, and you don't use their name, they're totally conscious of the fact, particularly if they say, hi, Marjorie, hi, Emily, and you go back and go, hey, how are you? They know. You have no idea what their name is, and it's a variation on impoliteness when you don't say thank you. Emily, don't go away.
Yeah, don't go away, because I have a question, Emily. Do you have any tricks on remembering people's names? Because I have a hard time with that.
I actually do. I read a couple of books about this. Number one way you can practice is when you're watching television at night, like you guys talk about The Daily Show and Colbert, practice remembering the guest's name. Practice when it goes to commercial, see if you can remember who they were just talking to. Also, when you first meet someone, just try to use their name 2 to 3 times in the conversation.
Okay.
Emily, can I tell you something? You're totally wasting your time. You're talking to Marjorie Egan, who on our former show, on one segment, this is totally true, called me by her dog's name and by her son's name and her ex-husband's name and her sister's name. Is that true? Tell the truth. Is that true?
I don't know. I did it in one show.
It was in one segment. Emily, don't go away. We're going to put you on hold. We want to find out how to find your article, and maybe we'll talk about it. Thanks so much for the call. 877
sort of blended together,
301-8970. But it's more of the same thing. The thank yous are connecting things. The names, as Emily said, are connecting things. I think they're great, and they're small, and they're easy.
Okay, let's go to Arama from Newburyport. Hi.
Hi, Rama.
Good afternoon, and merci beaucoup for having this conversation.
You're welcome. I like to throw in a
spasibo, a merci beaucoup. If I'm talking to someone of a foreign language, just to let them know I'm connecting with them on their level, which is something I like to do.
Yeah.
I don't know much beyond spasibo or merci beaucoup, but it's kind of a way to reach out, and it's a nice little thing. But I was guided to call up, and I had my phone in the back seat in a safe distance, so I wouldn't get on it while I'm driving, but you have corrupted me to actually get on my phone while I'm driving, but thank you anyways.
You're welcome.
Okay. The Dalai Lama said, I think, but I'm paraphrasing, be kind whenever possible. It is always possible.
That's pretty great.
Oh, I like that.
Gives me chills. That is great.
I love that.
Hey, Rama, we're glad you reached into the back seat. Drive safely. Thanks so much for the call. That's pretty great.
That is great. Well, it's a loving kindness thing you're supposed to be.
You know, by the way, you know they have books and things? They have about name. By the way, I have almost as bad
a
recollection as you do. It's really hard.
It has occurred to me to look into those little tricks.
And how's it going for you?
Well, obviously it's not going very well. I have tried.
You know how you know you're
in
trouble?
Failed.
When you shake someone's hand and they tell you their name, and as soon as they've said it, you've forgotten. What? No, I'm serious. Doesn't that happen?
I know.
It is horrible.
I know.
And you, what do you do? You say thank you. You hope that suffices. Let's go to...
And the other thing is, how many times can you
ask
without looking really
Which is why
obnoxious.
This name tag project, and I'll look it up and we'll talk about it next week or something,
is a
variation on the same theme.
Maybe that's why my neighbor invited me with the name tags, because she knew already my history. Let's go to Gary from work. Hi, Gary.
Hello, Gary.
Hi, how you doing?
Excellent.
Great.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say I am going to admit that I'm somewhere north of 60.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when gentlemen wore hats, they would tip hats to the ladies. They would give up their seats on the bus. And manners were more of a given than an exception.
Yeah, that's a good point, Gary.
Were people friendly, or was there a closer connection between people in the world at the time you're describing, or did it not make a difference, other than the fact that it's a nice thing to do?
In the town I grew up, that's the way I was raised.
How big a town did you grow up in, Gary?
About 23,000, upstate New York.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. And I was raised by the nuns and very strict parents, and manners was a big part of our lives.
By the way, and I had a mother, just so you know, who would write handwritten thank you notes for every single thing anybody did for her. So she grew up in the same era, and it mattered to her just like it matters to you.
Well,
Gary, thanks
up,
for the call.
The getting up for women thing has gone by the boards. I don't know if that's because of, you know, I always the joke about if the Titanic went down today, I don't think the women and children
would have gotten off.
No, I think it would have been every man, woman, and child for themselves. Because you notice that in the tea, how regularly people don't get up for women, even older people, or pregnant women.
Didn't that happen to you when
yes.
you were pregnant? One of
yes.
the, didn't that happen to you?
I used to take the tea all the time when I was pregnant with my first kid, and it was rare that somebody get up, even if I put my big belly, right, like 6 inches from their face.
And you would do that. Didn't you tell me you did that consciously
well,
in the hope?
Because you get so annoyed by it. You'd see some 25-year-old guy yeah. sitting there pretending he didn't notice you, so I made sure he couldn't use that as an excuse, and it didn't do any good. I still stood up, and he
well, the reason,
still sat down.
For whatever it's worth, I was reading, Marjorie. That's why I couldn't get up. I'm sorry. You know, let's not hold it against me forever. Enough already. Naomi, you're in Auburndale. We'll take a couple more quick ones. Naomi, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Naomi.
Love your show.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd be terribly embarrassed if anybody thanked me for doing something nice for somebody else. It should be automatic with all of us. We should be considerate of each other. And being on the tee, people do get up for me. I'm 81 years old now.
Ooh.
White hair. People say I look younger than I do. But for the most part, people have gotten up for me on the tee.
That's great.
And I have really thanked them and been appreciative. And if anybody else turned around and said, oh, that's very nice of you to thank them, I'd look at them in astonishment. I
now,
mean, we should all be being polite to each other.
Okay.
That
now,
was
I
great,
think this
Naomi.
Is fascinating.
Thanks.
Naomi said she was 81. Mm-hmm. The previous caller said he was over 60.
Yeah.
So maybe
oh, it's
because,
a generational
because
thing. No
their
question.
Attitude about it is so much different than someone who's 25 or 30. I mean, how many times do you see the classic thing you're supposed to do when I was little, which is if someone came over to your table, if you were out to dinner somewhere with your family and somebody came over to your table, everybody that was younger than that person
stood
was supposed
up.
To stand
I
up.
Know.
I don't think that happens anymore, does it?
Well, I told you, one of my favorite, just as an aside, quickly, I told you, Alison King did a documentary at NECN on the first 100 days of Deval Patrick, first 100 days as governor.
Oh, yes.
And there's a wonderful scene that I will never forget where he's at some high school. He doesn't know the camera's on him. And he walks over to two boys, high school kids, sitting there. And he walks over and he extends his hand and they don't stand up. And Patrick says to them, when a grown-up says hello to you, you stand up. And they finally stand up sheepishly. And then he says, and then you look that person in the eyes. And it was one of these great teaching moments.
What
it was
he
unbelievable.
Said after that?
Well, which was?
Pull up your pants.
Oh, pull up your pants. That's right. Last one we can squeeze in right here. Clark, you're in Beverly. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Clark.
Hey, thanks for taking the call, guys. I love the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Second time caller. I don't know if you guys remember me, but I got reamed out last time. You guys were asking about Black Friday, and I was the only one who said they saved some money and loved it. And then every other call after me bashed me. So
by the way, I'm still angry about that call, Clark, but I'll try to get over
it. Disgraceful.
What's up, Clark?
I wanted to just touch base. I didn't think that handing out the little cards might be a little silly, but I think that please and thank you is quite important. I just wanted to make a quick point to that. I'm the editorial director of a magazine in Beverly.
Oh, say what it is. What's the magazine?
Oh, it's called Manufacturing Digital. Check
okay.
it out online. You can find it.
Okay.
But my job is to get executives that are tough to get on the phone to do interviews.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to obviously go through gatekeepers to make that happen. Please and thank you is the way to get it done. And it's the way to get everything done. I think it should be done a lot more, and I think it's important.
Great call, Clark. Thank you so much for your second one. Make a third soon.
Yeah, and Jim wasn't rude to you that time at all.
I think you were the one who was rude
okay.
to him last
must,
time
I
called.
It must have been my fault, Jim.
In any case, thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Up next, has Amazon.com changed the value of the book? Has it forever changed the way we hunt and gather in the 21st century? Harvard Business School's Nancy Cain joins us next to talk about the Amazon effect. This is 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am, Jim Browdy. That was really embarrassing. And she's Marjorie.
Welcome to my world, Jim.
I know who the woman in red here is. Joining us in the Studio 3 for Open Mic is Nancy Kane. She's an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Nancy, it's great to see you.
It's great to be here.
Well, we're going to talk about Amazon.com, and everybody knows it's great customer service and very convenient, and whether or not it's good for books. Great piece in The New Yorker about this from an issue a couple of issues ago. But I'm wanting to know, Nancy, before we start this whole thing, are they talking about, are we debating whether it's bad for books in terms of like sales or in terms of what money authors can make, or what are we talking about?
So this article is by George Packer, you know, a well-known American writer and surveyor of the national scene. I think his argument is kind of complicated. I think the gist of the piece, and it's relevant for our listenership, is, you know, is Amazon too big and too powerful for the social good? That's not a new question about companies, right? Remember the Microsoft debates of the late 1990s, or if you go farther back, the arguments about, you know, Standard Oil, which was broken up and then kind of reformed itself in the early 20th century, but reformed itself in the 20th. So this is, you know, I think the argument is about market power. It's about a power over other players on the landscape. So that part is curdles up little ideas or insights, little, you know, question marks about antitrust. It's an argument about, do you want distribution, content control, and even the pricing and form of books to be, which contain, Packer and lots of other people have argued, you know, a whole cluster of often important, you know, game-changing ideas. Do you want a lot of power clustered around, you know, that at that kind of chokehold? I think that's a very interesting question in a democracy where we like to argue with good reason that the generation and flow of free generation and flow of ideas is very, very important to holding on to, you know, the fundamental motivation of democracy, you know, individual initiative and collective will.
You know, the sub-headline in this piece is Amazon is good for customers. This is what Packer, or the headline writer, writes. But is it good for books? I assume, before I read this thing, Nancy Kane, it was the same old, fairly tired but important discussion about, well, they're going to put all booksellers out of business, particularly independent booksellers. But it's about books themselves, about authors themselves. Yeah. And Packer makes the contention that not only does Jeff Bezos, who significantly is now also the owner of the Washington Post, not only doesn't care about books at all, and frankly, never cared about books. That when he created this online bookstore that revolutionized the world, now called the Everything Store, I guess is the jargon, in 1994, it wasn't about selling books at all. It was about gathering data, he says, on wealthy or upper middle class and middle class consumers so he could sell them everything else.
Totally. The books were an entry point. There's very little historical debate about that, right? Smart hedge fund, former hedge fund, you know, staff,
30 years old,
described by all kinds of people that knew him at the time as very, very smart, very driven, very ambitious. And he was very clear very early on that books, you know, made a lot of sense as an entry point, partly because they were dispersed, right, widely dispersed in terms of availability. So you could collect all these titles online and give people access to books they wouldn't otherwise have, and bookstore. And if they live in a remote area, an effective bookstore. And they were away because
easy to ship and didn't break.
Very easy to ship, didn't break. There's not going to be quality control issues. Yep. It's not perishable, et cetera. All those things. Interestingly enough, I remember very early on talking to one of their early employees who was a graduate of the school, and her talking about how important it was that a lot of influencers from on both coasts and in the middle of the coast, and, you know, in the center of the country, read books. So getting attention on this, he thought, would be good, you know, business model and business image building. He turned out to be very right about that. So it was clearly about a runway to what he saw very early on as the astounding growth and astounding potential of the internet, right? And it was going to gather information and build out the runway to what Brad Stone calls in his, you know, relatively new book, very good book on Amazon, the Everything Store. Interestingly enough, last kind of historical tidbit that I learned in this article that I did not know before, the original, or at least kind of working name of the business, was Relentless. And supposedly the company still owns the URL to that, so I leave it to our listenership to go out and Google Relentless and see if you get taken to the Amazon website.
That's what he says. He says if you go to relentless.com, which I meant to do and I forgot.
And I have not done
that. If you go to relentless.com, you automatically are moved over to Amazon.
So that in itself tells you a little bit about, right, what this was about, as opposed to, you know, creating the world's, you know, most reverential and convenient and accessible and largest bookstore.
Well, he gives us the opening paragraph of this, and it's so true, but you don't think of it. And when you see him write it all down, that Amazon is also a hardware manufacturer like Apple, a utility like Con Edison, a video distributor like Netflix, yep, a publisher like Random House, mm-hmm, production studio like Paramount, yep, literary magazine, grocery deliverer. He goes on and on and on, talking about the UPS maybe having the things fly over. Now, what do you call those things that are going to fly?
Drones.
Drones, yeah.
And P.S., let's remember the deal that Amazon's cut with U.S. Postal Service, right, to deliver in certain places on Sunday. So they're also right now indirectly kind of feeding, right, revenue to the United States Post Office.
But he also says, and Ms. Harvard Business School over there, Nancy Kane, that it still struggles to stay in the black. How can that be?
So I did my usual numbers homework. So let me just give you a few of the numbers and I'll answer your question. So just to put it in perspective, they report on a calendar year. So last year, 2013, revenues were $74.5 billion. Their stock price as of yesterday, so I don't have it for today, was about $360, $359.82. And their market cap, the value of all those shares outstanding at $360, is 165 billion people. They employ somewhere between 84 and 110,000 people, depending on who you ask and how they're counting. And their net income on that $74.5 billion was $282 million. So that's just a small bit of that,
yes,
right? It's one-fifth of 175th. So, and if you look at the income, the SEC filings, it's very sporadic. They had a lot of profit in fourth quarter, right, holiday sales. They have no profit in second quarter and third quarter. In fact, it's negative profits, which have to be offset, right, the positive profit in first and fourth quarter. So they still go in and out of the black. And the answer to how has to do with infrastructure build. So one of the fascinating things about Jeff Bezos is that he, like John Rockefeller, is building, and this has been true from the very beginning. This is why they didn't turn into the black much earlier, you know, after becoming a company and then becoming a public company in the late 90s. He's built his own warehouses. He's built his own, you know, astounding logistics and customer data collection facilities. When you call them a utility, or George Packer calls them a utility, he's talking about web hosting and web operation services that they sell to company institutions as diverse as the New York Times and the CIA, just to mention a few. So they have had to build, like Rockefeller, you know, ultimately owning exploration oil fields all the way down to Mobil and Exxon gas stations. They have had to build an enormous amount of the value chain, which they now own and control. So a huge amount of the money is not about paying enormous salaries to employees or even I actually don't know the exact compensation landscape, but it's not primarily about returning it to shareholders or anything like that. It is about building infrastructure for a company that's relentless and that, as Jeff Bezos still says, every day is day one.
So wait a second. So I would bet if we did a poll of people listening to this show that a significant majority would agree with, let's say, Tom Menino from last year in saying, we don't want a Walmart near us. Too big, too impersonal, too this. Why does everybody love to hate Walmart but loves to love Amazon?
So that's a great question, because when I first read this article, I actually talked about it in my class the next day, because what struck me, the Packer article, and there, Chelsea Mertz, one of your superstar staff members, sent me another interesting article from The Nation, right, admittedly, you know, of admitted political proclivities or sympathies, called The Amazon Effect, which is also very, very interesting. One of the things that struck me is how little we know about how big and tentacular, I use that word carefully, right, tentacular, tentacle-like, its reach is.
He doesn't disclose anything. He doesn't have to, right, Bezos?
And the company is notoriously, like Apple, secretive. So I think Americans don't know much about it. Now, there's beginning to be interesting little, if you will, slices and dices of some of the aspects of the company, like, you know, these lawsuits being brought around, you know, working conditions in some of their warehouses,
which,
right?
Which sounds horrible.
Well, they sound pretty undesirable.
Like how fast they have to move to get all
how
the product.
How fast they have to move, you know, the security lines to get in and out that don't get paid for, that take 20 minutes, all kinds of stuff, right? The temperatures in them, which, you know, have since been remedied in some of these warehouses. Yeah, they have shades of what we read about Walmart, at least at certain moments in Walmart's history. So I think one of it is we don't know as much. Secondly, whole range of the chattering classes are dedicated, right? In some cases, addicted users of Amazon, right? You know, they, you know, just one click. I need paper towels, right? I need a lock, a TSA tested lock, because I'm going abroad tomorrow. I hit my Prime membership. I think there are huge numbers of very, very influential people that use Amazon and depend on it now. And this is even before they start selling groceries and the range of things they're expected
and
to roll.
Doing same day delivery.
And doing same day delivery in certain cities. So I think that's a piece of it as well. And I think a third piece of it is you have to step back now and really look at the reach of this company. It's much bigger reach than Apple. We don't think of it that way, but it's reach across industries, across players, across customer sets is just so broad and growing. And again, you have a leader and a team that is not relentless, that is not investing for tomorrow or the next day or even next year. They are investing for 2070, right? They are investing to build an enormously powerful entity that reaches around the world and uses the evolving power of the digital, not the internet revolution anymore, the digital revolution to have extraordinary market power.
That's the voice of Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School. So let me ask you two questions. One is the one we started with. What is Packer's thesis that leads him to ask the question, is Amazon.com good for books? And what's your answer to the question? Okay. And number two, the corollary question is not only is Amazon good for books, but is Jeff Bezos good for newspapers? I mean, he bought the Washington Post, as people know, in a very celebrated purchase. So take either one.
Okay, so let me start with the first one. So I think what Packer winds his way to, it's a long article. It's got full of interesting data. So, you know, whether the thesis is as clearly advanced as it might be, right, there's lots of good things in there. What he winds his way to is the culture within Amazon as he can reconstruct it. Now, he's not there. Right? He doesn't live there. It's a secretive culture. People are very loyal to Amazon. I have a student of mine right now, a superstar, seems like a really great guy, and he's been there and he's going back, right? He thinks it's a very exciting place to be. So as best that Packer can reconstruct it, he says this is an anti-book culture. Like, they, you know, let's get books down to 99 cents, get them out on our Kindles, right? You know, and he uses this line, which I think perhaps may very well be unfair, but boy, is it powerful for those of us that read books for a living. You know, the book is like a sandwich. Let's figure out how to market it really cheap and get it out there. And so that's the first thing. Books are a commodity that is not necessarily very different than lots of things that are sold, and they don't demand it. It demands care in consumer convenience and access, but the care of the content is not something that he perceives as being widely shared in the culture of the company. And he has lots of historical examples of how the culture has evolved from an editorial culture to now a culture driven by algorithms and data and slotting fees. Right, mm-hmm. Publishers pay big, big slotting fees, right, to get onto Amazon,
right,
and to stay on Amazon. They don't pay them. The buy button from their publications disappears. No publisher today can withstand that kind of, you know, twisting of the arm, if you will. So that's the first piece. The second piece is that there is something here. We talked about it briefly when we were talking about Silicon Valley several months ago. There is something here about technology, again, being the holy grail. Right, we've got the technology, we've got the algorithms, we have logistics that are powered by technology, we use the data, we have the Kindle readers. All is well in Gotham City, right, if we have that. And yet, if you talk to publishers, right, who a lot of tech people think of as, you know, the rotary phone, totally outdated, quaint, but absolutely adding very little value, they will tell you that great books written by people that are willing to take a chance on an idea or a plot or some kind of perspective, right, aren't things that are created by algorithms, right? They're created by the messy, messy alchemy of people who know how to think and know how to and have the discipline to put those thoughts on paper well and accessibly. And so Middlemarch, for example, never would have come to life if Jeff Bezos and his team had been doing their algorithms on it. No way, Jose. And so the second way that Packer argues that they're good for books is you can't really completely obsolete or even significantly obsolete the human appreciation and human judgment and human discernment and even The publisher's advance, which will quickly disappear in this race to the bottom in pricing, for people who can't otherwise afford to write. Because a lot of great writers didn't have a speaker's fee they could depend on to get their good books out. So, you know, it's a nested argument. It's an indirect argument. It's an interesting argument. But from what I experience as a sociologist and historian of what I feel is a naive and way under nuanced, not very deft embrace of technology as some kind of panacea substantively and structurally for our society, that piece rings very, very true to me.
So we only have a minute left. Okay. Is this bad news going to transfer to the newspaper
industry?
Well,
you know, so far, from what we know, again, indirectly, he's been very careful to say, I'm not going to mess with content.
Yeah, he was a bookseller in 1994.
And it looks like he's going to be a music seller, too, cutting into the Apple market as well.
Right. No,
that's their next plan.
No question. So, you know, I don't know. I really don't know whether he's gonna play a strategic and relentless game with the Post. Newspapers do not serve the function that online or brick and mortar retailers serve. It's a very different function. It's enormously important, and we don't know. The jury's out.
We only have 30 seconds. You're right.
I wish Edward R. Murrow was sitting next to Jeff Bezos in the corner office in Seattle. Let's put it that way.
So, Marty Baron, former editor of the Globe, is sort of nearby.
Yeah,
before you go,
you're
writing a new book about leadership, which we'll talk about a lot. Could that book get published in the world that Packer describes?
Oh, my book's, I'm going to be in trouble in this world, right? I'm past caring.
All of the youths are going to be in trouble, isn't it?
Isn't that kind of a bulwark?
So unusual books have never started off ahead of the starting gate, right? Ever. Books that are unusual, that have a different perspective, have different parts, never. There's the usual and the bestseller and the 50 Shades of Grey are going to be fine.
Can I tell you something? When your book comes out, Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School, Marjorie and I are going to stand up to Jeff Bezos on your behalf.
Okay.
Nancy Kane, thanks.
Nancy
Pleasure.
Kane is a historian at the Harvard Business School. She holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Nancy, a lot of emailers are big fans of yours.
So are we. By the way, we're big fans of Arlene in Westminster, Michael in Brewster, Patricia in Newton, who says, love Jim and Marjorie, Jane in Providence, Maureen in North Falmouth. We thank you all for your generosity. The phones are still open at 888-897-9424 or go online at wgbhnews.org.
Please tune in tomorrow for medical ethicist Art Kaplan on the latest medical news. We'll also be joined by music legend Judy Collins. I am Marjorie Egan.
Can't wait to meet Judy Collins.
Are you Jim Browdy?
I think I am.
Okay,
I'm Jim Browdy. I'm excited about Judy Collins, I must
thanks
admit.
Thanks to Chelsea, Will, Amanda, and John. And thank you all for tuning in. See you tomorrow.